Okay, so this is a more a little more mathematical oriented talk on Hodge theory. So I'm not going to review Hodge theory, at least now, not for the moment. But let me just say what I see as the most important aspect of Hodge theory, of Hodge in the 30s. And that is what it does, it gives a geometrical realization of topology, of homology. For example, let's take the main case of a Riemannian manifold. So one has homology, cohomology groups of the manifold going way back. But as we know, that a cohomology or homology class, they're very, they're not unique. They're very, you can move them around and you still have the same class. And so what Hodge theory does is to give a unique representative, a geometric representative, rigid, for each homology class on a manifold. I think that's the main thing that Hodge theory does. On a Riemannian manifold, it gives something via, it could be interpreted as via some optimization. So by an optimization problem, one gets a unique representative of every homology class. Okay, so that's why I think it becomes so important, because it really gives a connection between geometry and topology, but it does so in a very substantial way by giving this unique representative, provided there is this underlying Riemannian structure. Okay, that's classical Hodge theory. So Hodge theory is great. It's inspired us. But it has a lot of limitations. For example, we saw in the talks today, yesterday, of Wang Yusu, Wang Bai, both on situations which were not manifolds, but in the need of topological geometrical analysis. And moreover, there are many, many situations where we know the classical Hodge theory doesn't work. One of the main ones is where you have a finite space. If you have a finite space, the Riemannian metric trivializes, and the Hodge theory says nothing. And so we would like to have a Hodge theory in particular for a finite space. And one of the points I would like to make, there is a finite Hodge theory of simplicial complexes due to Ekman in the 30s, which overlaps with what we do, but it's different. So we interpret finite Hodge theory in a different way than Ekman and combinatorial Hodge theory ever since. So combinatorial Hodge theory, the sum of the things we do, but it's a different perspective, and I'd like to try to make that clear as we proceed. Other things that motivated us originally was spaces of images. Spaces of images are not manifolds, and one could well understand why a Hodge theory might be useful in analyzing spaces of images. Quantum field theory, quantum fields. Another example, the singular spaces that I mentioned, which are not manifolds. These are all some of the motivations for our original moving into Hodge theory. Okay, so what I'm going to do is to give this Hodge theory. It was first developed in this form by my son, Nat Smale, and myself, starting about 4 or 5 years ago. And this is a long history of ups and downs, but our we were finally joined by two people, Thomas Schick, Laurent Bertoldi, in a 50-page paper, which has gone through a long process of refereeing, and it's just been processed. So it should appear in the Journal of FOCM pretty soon. maybe at least online. So that's a good reference, this 50-page paper. There's a lot of things to say, and I'll try to say some of the main things now. And there's some new things after the paper, too, I'd like to get to. Okay, so we start with this space X. And we want to have a metric, just an ordinary distance function, say D, so it's compact space, and we put a measure on it, a finite measure, a probability measure, say. Use a probability measure. And besides these ingredients, we have one more ingredient that is harder to understand. It's a scale. So if I can communicate something about a scale, I'll accomplish something here, I think. A scale is something related to a lot of mathematics of the last decades, image processing and so on, multi-scale mathematics, wavelets, and persistent homology, which is closest to. But our scale is, while it's related, especially to persistence homology, it's different in concept in the sense it's a fixed scale. It's not that we can't change it, but we want to understand things at a fixed scale. We don't want to understand what happens as you change the scale so much as to understand what's going on at this fixed scale, alpha greater than zero. Maybe I should just mention an example. Suppose we take a circle and we take a bunch of points on that circle. Forget the circle now, just see these points. Depending on the scale, you can see the circle. If you have, say, 20 points here, and you're sitting at the back of the room, you might just see some kind of blur, or at least it may be a little farther back. Most room, you could imagine a circle here. And if you get very close, you just see the dots. So those have to do with different scales at which one studies this. So the natural thing would be to study this at a scale in which there is one-dimensional homology. That's what we want to do. But it's a fixed scale. If you take a scale too small or too big, you don't see that homology. Okay. So these are the ingredients for our Hodge theory. Okay, so I'll proceed directly. I want to define a neighborhood of a diagonal. And I'll call that U, depending on alpha, L plus 1. L is just a non-negative integer. This is going to be a neighborhood of a diagonal. So I call the diagonal, I guess I could call L plus 1, contained in here. This is, maybe I better just write, well, that's okay. And so this is going to be contained in X, the L plus 1, this neighborhood of that diagonal, and it's going to give us our notion of locality relative to scale alpha. So it's an alpha neighborhood of a diagonal in what people here would say is in the Czech sense. Okay, I'll define that precisely. We have a distance, say, of xy, where xy belong to x to the L plus 1, and we just have the distance max, distance xi, yi. And here I can put, for the moment, some d star. This is the distance on the product. But it's induced just by our distance d here. And this alpha here, is u alpha is n. So this is a pretty key thing to understand. Equals the set of all x belonging to x to the L plus 1, such that the distance of x to the diagonal is less than or equal alpha. So it's an alpha neighborhood of the diagonal in this precise sense. Czech neighborhood if you want. Okay, so this is going to be the basic space we use. All right? So I want to define a cohomology sequence on L2. There's a natural measure, a new L plus 1 alpha induced by our mu. You just take product measure restricted. Okay, so I'm going to work with L2 on that measure. So this is going to involve a certain amount of functional analysis. So I go from, say, UL alpha L2 with the measure I've just described. I want to define a co-boundary L2 UL plus 1 alpha into L2 UL plus 2 alpha and so on. So this is a chain of linear maps. Real valued, everything real valued. Everything is going to be real valued as we proceed, real valued, cohomology, homology. And this definition is, we take a function f in here, so I want to look at co-boundary of f. That's going to be something in here. So we evaluate that at x. So x belongs to ul plus 1 alpha. And this is, by definition, sum f of x 0 up to x l. And we take out, we omit the ith variable here. So this is a function of l variables. And f is defined as a function on l variables here. So this makes sense because f belongs to here. F belongs to this space. Co-boundary f belongs to this space. And so we get sum I equals 0 to L minus 1 to the L. I haven't lectured on this for a couple of years, or a year, maybe a year. So I, some of these things...
This has to be L plus 1. Like 0 and I have eliminated.
What's that again? This probably, that part's probably right. Okay. So this is the definition of a co-boundary operator. And there is a history of this. If one used not L2, but all functions, not continuous, not L2, but just all possible functions here, this is the definition of the Alexander-Spanier co-boundary. Okay, but they did Alexander-Spanier especially, did not worry about any topology on these spaces. They were just algebraic. So we can prove co-boundary squared equals 0. It's a proposition. Now I'm going to suppress the indices for the moment on co-boundary. Strictly speaking, this would be called co-boundary sub L. Okay. So this gives us already our cohomology, HL is equal to the kernel. Now maybe I should put this in co-boundary L. We should take L plus 1. This is going to be X. Then you can put L2 here, etc. Divided by the image. Co-boundary L. I think I have the indices right. So these are linear spaces, and this is a quotient linear space. Okay, so this is the key ingredient of our Hodge theory, this cohomology. All right? So the next thing we do is to define an adjoint. This is a bounded map. Co-boundary is a bounded linear map of Hilbert spaces. These are Hilbert spaces. Bounded linear map of Hilbert spaces, so we can take its adjoint. So this would be co-boundary L adjoint. Well-defined, also bounded. The Hodge, our Hodge operator is co-boundary, we index it by L. So it's going to go from that space into itself. This is our Hodge operator. These we call sometimes L forms. Elements of this space are L forms. And we can, might as well do it now, go to the case of alternating functions, invariants under the alternation. So I can assume all these are alternating. The theory works both with or without alternating, but at some point it makes more sense to deal with alternating functions. Okay, so this object, at scale alpha, all this is at a certain scale alpha. So alpha tells us, it measures how close we're looking at things. So there's a lot of geometry in these spaces. These are actually simplicial complexes. Even in the general non-finite case, they're still simplicial complexes in the sense of Eilenberg-Steenrod 50 years ago. And because you have to check a face of something in here is in here. And that satisfies, then it satisfies Eilenberg-Steenrod definition of simplicial complex. And it's useful sometimes to think of these as simplicial complexes that are highly infinite continuum number of elements, but they still are valid simplicial complexes. Okay, and here's the big point I want to anticipate. If we took X to be a finite space, this is a natural simplicial complex structure at a given scale alpha. In the very traditional sense of finite simplicial complex, you could say at scale alpha. So this is different than starting with a simplicial complex. We're just starting with a set of finite set of points, for example, and the scale, possibly a distance function, and we get simplicial complexes, and we get a cohomology theory and a Hodge theory. And this is a different approach than combinatorial Hodge theory that I mentioned before. Okay, so this is the Hodge operator. Our Hodge operator is simply co-boundary star plus co-boundary star co-boundary. And now you have to put the right indices so this makes sense. So the so this operator, Hodge operator, goes from this space to this space, and you can tell this is co-boundary L. You can just put in the right indices here. Okay, so that's what we want to do is study that. Okay. And here is the first main theorem. This is so this early development is done with Nat and myself. And then, so here's the condition. Suppose, let's do it for HL of X scale alpha is finite. Suppose the dimension of this is finite, and for simplicity, you say all L. That's the hypothesis we make. If that's true, then we have Hodge theory. This implies Hodge theory. Okay, so this says that the kernel, the co-boundary of L alpha is isomorphic to HL, what I write over here, L2 alpha. This is the theorem then. So I would say, in a sense, I mean, it took a long time to be able to say this, but it's a soft film. It's soft in some sense, in contrast to some other things that are hard films. Okay, then also have the Hodge decomposition, so we could write L2 of U L plus 1 alpha. This is the Hodge decomposition equals to the image of co-boundary plus image of co-boundary star. This is the Hilbert direct sum decomposition of this Hilbert space plus kernel. And then I left off the indices here and here. No. They are closed. They're closed because of our hypothesis. Okay, is that very clear? So that's, in some sense, the main soft result of the first stage of our work on Hodge theory. I think that's exactly precise if one puts in the indices sub L plus 1 and so on. All right. Maybe it would be good to give some examples. Okay, so suppose we take the space of 20 amino acids. Some of you were at my talk Monday. So we have for peptides and proteins, we have the space of amino acids that we found was lying at the core of so much of life, human life, in terms of alleles and representations of genes, peptides, and so on. And there I talked about a kernel, K1 for short. And from that we get a distance function, dA. Okay, so if we do all that, we get some things of interest, maybe less so in this case, for H0, but we prove H1 of the situation, if this is X, and we have appropriate alpha, then this is X. Has dimension 1. So in the space of amino acids, we have a Hodge one form. And it's unique. And actually, Linda Silber was visiting Hong Kong when we discovered this, and he helped. Let's try to understand that better. We understand it better partly because of him. We still don't understand the biological implications because we've been so distracted with other problems in our project to even look for such biological implications. But it's an interesting problem to understand this thing. Okay, here's another example. If we take a circle, and we take two points close enough, such as that, so they aren't antipodal, or a set of points like this. And we want to I'll define a one cycle here. So I want to say what F is. Going to U, alpha is like a quarter of the way around the circle. This would be 2 here, so it'd be a one cycle. So I would ask that f of x, y, here we have x and y, which are close because we're an alpha, this is equal to distance the arc distance between X and Y. Okay? That's a function on U2 alpha, and this we can prove is a one cycle, harmonic one cycle. This generates this group, this space, generates a homology, for example. It is the homology. So this is not too hard to understand. Not too hard to prove things here. And this generalizes to manifolds Riemannian of constant curvature. So if you take manifolds of constant curvature, then this will be the area of a triangle, a local triangle, where the points are close enough to define a geodesic triangle. Alpha is small enough so that we'll be sure that a set of points here will be in a ball on the manifold of radius alpha. It's a local convexity measure on the manifold. Of course, compact. And this is not so trivial to prove. I mean, this is pretty easy, but when one goes to manifolds, for example, this doesn't work if you don't have constant curvature. Okay, those are some examples. And, we've come across quite a few others. You know, already I think in dimension zero, these harmonic forms in dimension zero, those are classical harmonic functions that are essentially locally constant, locally defined in terms of alpha. So they're locally constant. And if you have a, so to speak, an alpha connected space, every two points can be joined by a sequence of points, each pair of which has distance less than alpha, then these harmonic functions are all constant. And you can talk about, in general, these harmonic functions here are those which have a property that at the center of a ball, they're equal to the integral around the whole ball. So it is a lot like classical harmonic analysis. But the objects now, though, are not functions. They're functions of two variables. So it's different that way. And all of this is certainly in the very first version of the main paper I mentioned, which is on my website also. All right, so this. Okay, for a while, for the first year or two that Matt and I were working on this, we thought that co-boundary, the map here, co-boundary has a closed image. In the so we wrote our first paper, all these things, and then some. Under that, believing that was true, and eventually Thomas Schick in Göttingen, he struggled with this, found a counterexample. So this is not true. Okay, so that created this big question, when does it have a closed image? And, for example, finite dimensional cohomology is sufficient. Yeah. Okay, so we could say, that's the main case, finite dimensional cohomology. And so with finite dimensional cohomology, we get this theorem. Finite dimensional HL alpha, fixed alpha. Then say X is a manifold, Riemannian manifold. And alpha is small, relative to those convex local balls defined by the Riemannian metric, convex balls. Then then above result, then Hodge, okay, Hodge decomposition. Etc. All these conclusions up there are true. Wait a minute, we have to be careful here. So this is not a hypothesis anymore. This is a part of the theorem. If alpha is small for a Riemannian manifold, then this is finite. So let me write it more grammatically. We'll just say theorem. We have finite dimensionality if X is a manifold and alpha is small. Therefore, this. Now I think I'm grammatically okay. Is that okay now? And so this is a what I would call a hard theorem. So Schick and Bertoldi themselves thought they had this, and that they had some big mistakes in it. And eventually, using their failed proof, Matt and I found the correct proof for this.
When you said before that something generalizes to manifolds of constant curvature, what exactly generalizes?
Oh, this construction. We take, for manifold of constant curvature, we take alpha sufficiently small, okay, and we define a function of, say, the manifold is dimension n, take a function of n plus 1 variables, okay, that corresponds to the highest dimensional class in the manifold, and that function we define to be the function of n plus 1 variables is going to be the volume of that simplex defined by these points. Okay, that's the generalization of this construction. And that is a harmonic n form on an n-dimensional manifold. Remember now, it's a function of n plus 1 variables, so we have to be, think what that means, and you're right to ask the question. Then you want to look at something, n-dimensional manifold, we want to look at n plus 1 here. And this construction, this goes over. To give a class of examples.
So in this case, when you have X and manifold, the X is a space of all possible points of the manifold X, right?
Yeah, X is a manifold as a space. Yeah. And the distance function, Riemannian distance function. And so this gives us the Hodge's decomposition in that case. And the proof is there's a lot of funny geometry on the Riemannian manifold, and it uses something like spectral sequences, algebraic topology, or some versions of spectral sequences.
Yeah, it is good because if alpha is very big, this conductiveness commands is
bigger. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so this is a main theorem. You know, this is a rich class of examples, and it ties things down to some kind of reality. And it's useful, too, because this kind of Hodge theory doesn't use calculus. It's just all just... simple topology, metric space topology. And then it uses, of course, the measure to get the adjoint. Here, this adjoint uses the fact we have L2 spaces, so it uses the measure. Okay? All right, so let me talk about the following. So this can be used in a lot of ways, just like classical Hodge theory, and it opens up a lot more problems. And then besides this theorem, one asserts that the L2 cohomology is the same as all the homologies of the manifold, the Rahm, singular, simplicial, and so on.
Why did
he not like... Oh, yeah. Here, everywhere, we use this. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but then we have, this the Rahm theory and so on. But there's a few things to say here. This proof is not constructive, not very constructive directly at least, in the sense that this does not construct an isomorphism of these groups to the classical groups, not directly. So it took us quite a long time. This is after our paper that's coming out, FOCM paper that Nat and I did, where we were able to construct an isomorphism directly between these groups and the de Rahm groups. And so this is on our website. This is a paper which was written after this paper has taken 2 years to process. And this was accepted immediately. So this is being published long before this. And so I don't know if it's on the website, but the idea is if you take a smooth manifold, so this is a manifold, then we have these two theories here. But the forms are quite different. The classical L forms are sections of cotangent bundles, and everything's smooth. And so our forms are functions, L2 functions on L plus 1, or on U L plus 1. So just identifying those two forms, those two kind of forms, the classical forms and our forms, well, we found chain maps which go in both directions between the classical L forms and our L forms. And so we do have those maps going both directions, chain maps, and they give a direct identification of the de Rahm groups and our groups. That's to be published soon, but it's on my website again with the two authors. Okay. So here's something that relates to these talks I mentioned and some of the questions that have come up in this meeting. And this is something very recent. I have something written here. This is written by Nat Snail, August 4th, 2011. And I must say, Nat is not too good at writing things up. So, you know, very rigorous, but there's no introduction and no corollaries. But he said that on the phone to me yesterday, it's fine if people want to look at this. You can have copies of it even, either by writing him or copying this paper here. And he's very careful about writing. And so it's this space called Alexandrov. Okay, so these are Alexandrov spaces are, you know, the general type spaces defined, say, X. And again, we need just a distance function and a measure. And now we suppose alpha again. And if alpha, if we suppose, here's the sum. If we take an Alexandrov space, with alpha small enough, like in the Riemannian manifold case, and we have to have a bound on the curvature, which makes sense for an Alexandrov space, then all this holds. We get this complete theory here. So this is a class of spaces, which I can't give it full definitions. Let me just give it the idea. If we take two points, which are connected in the Alexandrov space. This is towards the definition of the Alexandrov space. So we can find a path between these two points. Then we can find shorter and shorter paths. In fact, those which are defined by a finite set of points. And eventually, taking the minimum of each stage, you get a convergence to a unique path. Okay, so a little bit like geodesics in a manifold. That's the main part of the definition of an Alexandrov space. It includes a lot of singular spaces, and I'm certainly hardly know what these are. Manifolds with boundary, a lot of things we've heard about in the last days. And then, so the Alexandrov spaces, these class of singular spaces, we have then a good, useful Hodge theory. Finiteness is implied. You don't have to assume the finiteness. Question? Okay. Yeah, the finiteness is implied. Curvature, upper bound on the curvature. Yes. That's the main hypothesis on the Alexandrov space. Mm-hmm. And I have this paper here. If somebody wants to borrow it or make copies, it's okay. Okay. It's getting the problem is there's just so many things to say. I don't know. A lot of the things I know best are in these papers I mentioned. And the long paper and then the little bit shorter paper on the smooth manifold case where everything, you know, comes together somewhat. But let me just indicate there are a lot of problems everywhere one looks. For example, we showed in some cases that our maps, which go from the L forms to the L forms and the two senses, that they are they do give an isomorphism on the Rahm cohomology, and we don't know exactly the situation whether they preserve harmonic forms in one sense to another. We prove that in a number of cases. Constant curvature sometimes, not always. For two manifolds, yes. Then the harmonic forms correspond. One forms correspond. So a lot of situations, but we don't have real counterexamples. And another theorem that goes way back is supposedly to have a one of these forms so that this Laplacian alpha L2 of F equals 0. So F belongs to what? L2 U L plus 1 alpha. And of course, these are all topological spaces or metric spaces. Suppose we have such a form, then we can ask, is F continuous? It's a regularity theorem. Like a harmonic form classically is C infinity on a C infinity manifold. If we have a C infinity manifold, we don't even know if F is continuous for us. So this is something that could be true in the complete generality of what I've been speaking, that the harmonic forms are always continuous. And we prove that in a few cases, one forms and some other special cases. But this is a seems to be hard problem. You know, it's probably not true. I don't know. It's just
in the case of manifolds.
In case of manifolds,
yeah.
In the case of manifolds, we don't know it. For small alpha, we don't know. Somewhat different. Yeah, maybe. But it may be for a C infinity manifold, one could expect. They can't be the same. But under these isomorphisms I mentioned, because they're functions on different spaces and so on. So the question is a correspondence. Okay. And there's a question, though, just by itself. Take the case of a smooth Riemannian manifold. Forget the classical theory. C infinity manifold. Ask this question. We don't know the answer.
In particular, in case of smooth manifold, it's smooth function.
Yes, smooth or even continuous. It might be C infinity. Could be. We tried it a lot. For common examples and for to prove this. But it's not so easy.
Can you say a word about how you go from the differential forms to this thing?
So if we have a differentiable form, so we have something, say, omega, this is a hard direction. And now we want to describe C. Omega. This is going to be our chain map. So this is going to belong to L2 U L plus 1 alpha. Okay? And so we first, let's not worry about the L2 part. Let's just try to get it to C infinity. All right? And then from C infinity to L2. Okay, so what is this? So the idea is as follows. And this is a little, this is a tricky map. So we want to say what is C of omega at points x0 up to xl. Okay? And then the idea is to construct some kind of pseudo simplex. And this is general, so it's really a pseudo simplex. And then one uses Stokes theorem, because here we're now everything is C infinity. Use Stokes theorems to see that this is a chain map. And constant curvature is easier, yes. So we have to be careful about averaging over orders and things like that. Because if you take a different order, then you get a different geometric object. But anyway, that's in our second paper. This map is described in great care. Smooth map, and this is a one of the directions of the map which exhibits the Rahm theorem, because it's a chain map. In the inverse, phi going the other way, this goes from L2UL plus 1 to lambda L. This is defined by the following. Here we use alternating. And what we do is we show, because the alternating hypothesis, lower derivatives vanish at the diagonal. And so what we'll do is we just take a certain order jet of order L plus 1. And that's an alternating form and is well defined, and that gives us this map, which is inverse to this, also a chain map. It's not a complete inverse because these are not the same spaces. I mean, this is not the same space as this, far from it. But in one direction, it's a pseudo inverse. But they're both chain maps, so that gives us some good hold on comparing the two theories. Okay, well, I think maybe that's enough of a fairly concentrated talk. Thank you. Yeah.
The example in the case, you have mentioned about it is the first application of.
You can. I don't know. We find some things, but we don't develop them too much. Especially
harmonic in
USF. Just for zero forms, we spend a lot of time looking at the zero form. That has a lot to do with clustering questions at a certain scale, and there we look at changes of scale. So we look at lots of situations, but. I would say nothing too compelling. Clustering is a pretty big deal, and I'll talk about clustering that has to do with zero dimensions Friday for genes. Yeah.
Do you have any theorems about the spectrum of Euler
functions? Zero dimensional for functions. That's just zero dimensional. Then we can say a lot. Yeah, so then it's reminiscent of the graph Laplacian. Different interpretation. And so there we have some pretty good understanding of it. Yeah, zero dimension. And when you get to one dimension, when you get high dimensions, then we think it's not discrete. But we don't have a clear picture that it's not discrete. But you know the map pretty well, like Hodge theory. It goes from forms of one degree to forms. Cobondi goes naturally in the Hodge decomposition from forms of one degree to coforms of the next degree. So you can do a lot of the things you can do with classical Hodge theory. Yeah.
Is it reasonable to suppose that in this case, with your manifold, this sort of your theory, these Laplacians are Fredholm? The corresponding eigenspace for any small eigenvalue finite
dimensional. Well, that's what multiplicity is. Yeah, say in the nice case of this theory, Riemannian manifold alpha small, then it's possible, yeah. We can't prove that. Continuous is a little different question.
Yeah.
It's a little different. So, we certainly can't prove that it's Fredholm.
Cannot.
So for the higher order Laplacians. But in this case, of course, it does have a finite dimensional kernel.
Yeah.
So some things we could have pursued more that we didn't. So I'm not sure. So that case, we could probably pursue things somewhat more. But I'm not sure if anything would be easy. Yeah. I think we bypass Hodge star. Because, see, we're working in situations which there is no Hajdar. There is no duality. They're not manifolds anymore. So, yeah, that's something we looked at a lot. What's the role of Hajdar? And you probably could do it in the case of C-infinity manifolds. You probably find something like a star operator. But only in that case. In the general case, one thing we were successful in doing was bypassing the Hajdar. Because the Hajdar plays a big role in the classical Hajj theory. And we couldn't define the Hajdar in our generality planet sets even. It's not natural. So we don't have it. Yeah. That's a great subject, which we don't know how to do. We have an approximation in terms of finite samples for the zero-dimensional case. But for a higher-dimensional case, it's not so easy. Because for each finite approximation, we have a very clean picture. And what happens is you take more and more sample, higher and higher set of samples, bigger set of samples. I don't know. I'm not saying it'd be very hard, but we didn't, with a little effort, didn't succeed. No, but that's a good problem. That's a good problem. It's a good question and a very good problem, and probably true. Probably true. But not. I don't think it's easy. Oh, yeah, we say pretty precisely. I mean, it has to, we write it down in terms of the, what's the word, geodesically convex balls in the manifold?
Radius of
alpha. Radius of convexity. Or, yeah. But on the other hand, we haven't found counterexamples for large alpha. That's something we spent some time. Take alpha large, what happens? That. Oh, of course, alpha gets very large, then you lose everything. Let's take intermediate values of alpha. What's the story? And that's something I think would be pretty interesting. I spent some time on that, and you get counterexamples to a lot of arguments. Something, there's a lot of questions just about the finiteness. We prove a finiteness under this condition. When is that homology, when are those homology groups finite? Well, Thomas Chick in our paper has a counterexample in general, but those are interesting and tough questions. We have quite a bit to say about those things in our big paper, finiteness. And those are, yeah.
I think the universal cover of a compact manifold, when you look at the orthocormality, of course, it's not finite dimensional.
Uh-huh.
If you take disclosure about it, what you think,
yeah. Well, I don't know. Well, it's not quite so. I don't think it's so simple.
No. I'm saying that the fact that it's not that it requires something like that.
Yeah. But just the image being non-closed, Chick found that's a very, very complex and subtle counterexample. I just still don't understand it very well. It's a very subtle counterexample. And he's an expert on L2 cohomology.
Yeah.
Who? Oh, yeah. Everything just to define the Laplacian. Huh? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, here we're using just mu to be the Riemannian measure. Yeah. So if you just play around with mu too much, you're not going to get any of these theorems to change mu around. I mean, there's some things, if you have a finite sample and take the uniform measure on the finite sample, then you want to, then That's okay. That's natural. Still, we don't have the thumbs. Tomorrow?
No, sorry, Friday. Friday, 2:30.